Hello, and welcome to this reading of the Sioux City Journal for today, Friday, July 1st. I'm your reader, Mark Bedford. Let's start with today's weather. Today should be a blend of sun and clouds with a high of 87 degrees. Tonight should be partly cloudy with a low of 62. And tomorrow, Saturday, will be partly sunny with a stray thunderstorm and a high of 84. And now, these local news stories. Getting ready for SITP. Even with glut of competing festivals, Bernstein excited by SITP lineup. Earl Horlick reports from Sioux City. You wouldn't think that Saturday in the Park, or SITP, would have supply chain woes, but the festival's co-founder, Dave Bernstein, said it was a concern. I thought we'd have a problem getting volunteer t-shirts delivered in time, he said, during a Wednesday afternoon news conference held in Grandview Park. That didn't turn out to be the case. Instead, it was a shortage of CO2 canisters needed for fountain drinks, which was giving Bernstein a few last-minute headaches. Don't worry, there will be enough canisters to meet demand when Siouxland's premier music festival returns at noon Saturday. Plus, there'll be plenty of top-drawer acts. Last year, the bookings were actually easier since acts wanted to get back on the road after COVID, he said. This year, most acts were back to touring, but the glut of festivals made the market very competitive. Nevertheless, Bernstein was happy with this year's lineup, which included an encore performance from the Abbott Brothers, who had previously headlined SITP in 2014, as well as 85-year-old blues legend Buddy Guy, who had also played the Free Music Festival in 1993 and 2004. Other main stage performers will include Sioux City-based bands Servant Shop and Artificial Stars, as well as folk rockers Doc Robinson and award-winning recording artist L. King. We'd wanted to book L. King for a while, Bernstein said of the performer best known for the bluesy single X's and O's. People are already talking about her. The indie-rocking duo Daisy the Great, made up of musicians Mina Walker and Kelly Nicole Dugan, canceled their show Thursday after Dugan was diagnosed with COVID. They were replaced at the last minute by Terrence Simeon and the Zydeco Experience, a band that blends New Orleans funk reggae with a bluesy Zydeco beat. This year's ABE stage artists include an eclectic lineup of local, regional, and national talents, including the Austin, Texas-based rock duo Black Pistol Fire and Grammy Award-nominated rapper Fetty Wap. In addition to the music, SITP will also have a kids' zone, arts alley, and a host of food and drink vendors. We're asking everyone to leave their beer coolers at home, Bernstein said. Please respect that SITP is a free festival, made possible in part by beer sales. No outside alcoholic beverages will be allowed inside of the park. New this year will be offering from such local craft breweries as Jackson Street Brewing, Marto Brewing Company, and Brew City Brewery. That's B-R-I-O-U-X, City Brewery. Water bottle refilling stations will be located at various sites throughout the park for folks wanting to stay hydrated on a day which is expected to have partly cloudy skies and a daytime high in the upper 80s. To avoid traffic snafus to and from Grandview Park, Bernstein recommended taking a shuttle bus. Starting at 11 a.m. Saturday and continuing to the end of the festival, shuttle buses will be picking up patrons near the fountain area at the Tyson Events Center at 401 Gordon Drive. Due to its COVID-19 hiatus in 2020, Bernstein wasn't certain what year it was for the annual music festival he founded with his friend Adam Figs in 1991. We don't know if this qualifies as the 32nd SITP since it was held over 2 days last year, and we don't know what to say about 2020 because the festival was canceled due to the pandemic, Bernstein said. Regardless of how many SITPs there's been in the past, he credited the continuing success to the hundreds of volunteers, organizations, and businesses who work to keep things going year after year. We wouldn't be here without the support of the community, Bernstein said. They're a big part of Saturday in the Park. Iowa Supreme Court reverses precedent on hog farms. David Pitt reports from Des Moines. The Iowa Supreme Court on Thursday reversed a long-standing precedent that allowed landowners to sue for damages when a neighboring hog farm causes water pollution or odor problems that affect quality of life. The court concluded 4-3 that a 2004 decision was wrong. The earlier ruling established that a portion of Iowa's law providing immunity to livestock farms from neighbors' nuisance lawsuits violated the Inalienable Rights Clause of the Iowa Constitution. It also found neighbors could sue if they had lived in the area long before the farm began operating, had sustained significant hardship, and did not benefit from the nuisance immunity granted to the livestock farm. Justice Thomas Waterman wrote in the Thursday decision that protecting and promoting livestock production is a legitimate state interest, and granting partial immunity from nuisance suits is a proper means to that end. Iowa is the nation's leading pork producer with 23 million pigs, most kept in large confinement buildings that collect nitrogen-rich manure from the animals and use it to fertilize fields. The court said judges must use a rational basis to review future court challenges, a standard that will be difficult to overcome because it presumes state laws are passed for the benefit of the public. The decision is a significant blow to property owners in rural areas who want to take legal action over expanding hog farms. It's going to make it more difficult. It was difficult anyway as it was, said Wallace Taylor, the attorney representing landowner Gordon Garrison, who bought 300 acres of land in Emmett County in northwest Iowa in 1972, built a home there in 1999, and was disturbed in 2015 when farmer J.D. Moore built a 4,000-pig operation about half a mile away. Garrison said he could smell its odor more than 100 days of the year, sometimes all day, and it caused him to experience nausea and dizziness that forced him to stop working outdoors. Other neighbors supported his complaints. He also complained of water pollution caused by manure spread on adjacent farm fields. Garrison sued in 2020, calling the hog farm a nuisance. A district court judge dismissed his lawsuit in May 2021, and he appealed. Waterman wrote Thursday that balancing the competing interests of hog farmers and neighbors is a quintessentially legislative function involving policy choices our Constitution places with the elected branches. Under the ruling, property owners can sue when the damage results from a farm's failure to comply with a federal or state law or regulation, or when the farmer failed to use prudent and generally accepted management practices. The Iowa Supreme Court restored the Iowa legislature's role in striking a balance between the right to farm and the impact on those who choose to live in rural Iowa, said James Prey, the lawyer who represented Moore. The Iowa High Court has 6 conservative justices appointed by Republican governors and 1 Democratic appointee. Last Friday, the court overturned its 2018 decision that guaranteed Iowans the fundamental right to abortion under the state constitution. Justices Brent Appel and Christopher McDonald wrote in dissenting opinions that they would have upheld the 2004 case that provided for hog farm challenges. Justice Dana Oxley agreed. Appel said the purpose of the Inalienable Rights Clause in the Bill of Rights is to ensure that individual liberties are not subject to erosion by an aggressive legislative or executive branch. Are we telling the existing property owners that they are required to take one for the team as the private owners next door emit nuisance odors under a scheme of statutory immunity? He wrote. McDonald said Iowa's law immediately deprives a property owner of the right to assert a private nuisance action and seek full compensation, and that other states allow time for neighboring landowners to sue. In the end, the legal question presented in this case is a simple one. Does the Constitution mean what it says? Do the men and women of this state have the constitutional right to protect their property? The text of the Constitution, precedent, and history says yes. The majority says no, he wrote. Taylor said Iowans need to elect legislators who will rein in the livestock industry, who will listen to their concerns and repeal the nuisance immunity law for hog farms. Nikki Haley headlines Feenstra Family Picnic. Jared McNett reports from Sioux Center, Iowa. no matter the speaker at Republican Representative Randy Feenstra's second annual family picnic fundraiser at the Dean Classic Car Museum on Thursday, a common refrain could be heard and a common opponent was repeatedly named. Whether it was from the keynote speaker, former UN Ambassador Nikki Haley, or Governor Kim Reynolds, U.S. Representative Marionette Miller-Meeks, or Iowa Secretary of Agriculture Mike Naig, the 300-plus people gathered heard the Republican speakers say a version of Feenstra's 2022 campaign sign slogan, "Randy Delivers." "Look what he's done in the minority. Think of what he can do in the majority," Reynolds said, referring to Republican efforts to retake control of the House this fall. After ending her remarks, Haley asked the crowd to stand and cheer for the one-term congressman from Hull. "You have one fantastic pro-life, pro-Second Amendment, pro-freedom congressman," Haley said. The words were not so kind for President Joe Biden and other Democrats. Haley, who served as UN ambassador under former President Donald Trump, accused Biden of falling all over himself to re-enter a deal with Iran to curb the proliferation of nuclear weapons in the Middle Eastern nation. "When America is distracted, the world is less safe," Haley told the attendees, who paid $50 or more for a picnic lunch. Haley, 50, spent Wednesday and Thursday at several events in Iowa, fueling speculation of a potential 2024 run for president. Feenstra's 4th district is the most Republican in the state and considered a key to winning the state's first-in-the-nation GOP caucuses. In April 2021, Haley said she wouldn't run for president if Trump decides to launch another bid. During a Q&A with reporters Thursday, Haley dodged questions about her White House aspirations. "If it looks like there's a place for me, I'll put 100% in," Haley said. During her 15 minutes at the podium, Haley condemned the governments in China, Iran, and Russia, and the Biden administration's handling of foreign affairs. The former South Carolina governor also said Florida's so-called "Don't Say Gay" bill, which aims to limit what teachers are allowed to discuss regarding gender and sexual preference in schools, didn't go far enough. While discussing rising inflation, Haley, a former president of the National Association of Women Business Owners, said she worried about the impact to individual Americans. "They're having to pay more money for gas, and that's not going to get to work. They're having to pay more money at the grocery store, and that's how they feed their families." Joan Hextra, who attended the fundraiser, said the economy was her top issue heading into the general elections, getting it back to where it was. Feenstra accused Democrats of creating one crisis after another and doing more to protect meat packers instead of meat producers. In the House, Feenstra has pushed for a version of the Cattle Market Transparency Act, which would require beef packers to purchase more of their cattle through bidding in open markets. When Naig had his turn to talk, he praised Feenstra for the work he had done on behalf of livestock producers. The Ag Secretary went on to herald the Supreme Court's Thursday morning decision to limit the Environmental Protection Agency's ability to power plant emissions. Before the campaign speeches started, State Senator Jeff Taylor, Republican from Sioux Center, led a prayer and thanked God for the Supreme Court ruling that overturned the landmark 1973 Roe v. Wade decision that found a constitutional right to abortion. Almost a week after the decision, Miller-Meeks said flatly, "When it comes to life, Randy delivers." During Thursday's Q&A after the event, Feenstra was asked about the possibility of a nationwide abortion ban. In response, he talked about his faith but didn't offer any concrete action items. The notion of safety came up repeatedly during the fundraiser, as Feenstra listed what he saw as the vast differences between Northwest Iowa, where he grew up, and the nation's capital, where he serves. He said, "In D.C., if I go run, I worry." Reynolds, who's running for re-election against businesswoman Deidre DeGeer in November, said she helped make Iowans' lives easier by keeping businesses open during the COVID-19 pandemic and by reducing the length of time residents can claim unemployment benefits. "When you pay people to stay home, they stay home," Reynolds said. "We're going to do everything we can to get people back to work sooner." Iowa Workforce Development's May report showed open jobs totaling more than 85,000, while the number of unemployed Iowans stood near 47,000. "We're making great progress, and we're not done," the governor said. When he spoke, Feenstra said it wasn't enough to simply win big. He said Republicans also need to have some semblance of a plan. Then we can make this country prosperous again, Feenstra said, and be respected on the world stage. Ex-South Sioux City coach pleads guilty in child porn case. Nick Heitrich reports from Lincoln, Nebraska. Former South Sioux City High School assistant football coach Nathan Rogers pleaded guilty Thursday to possession of sexually explicit materials connected to a relationship with an underage girl. Rogers, 26, entered his guilty plea to production of child pornography in U.S. District Court in Lincoln. The prosecution agreed to dismiss a second count, receipt of child pornography, at sentencing. By reaching a plea agreement with prosecutors, Rogers avoided going to trial in the case. A sentencing hearing is scheduled for September 23rd before District Judge John Garrard. Rogers was charged with taking video of sexual activity and receiving pornographic images from October 11, 2020 through February 20, 2021. Authorities who were reviewing contents of Rogers' cell phone during a sexual abuse complaint involving Rogers and a 15-year-old girl discovered photos and videos of him having sex with a second girl. The two also had sent each other nude photos of themselves on their phones. Rogers still faces state charges for his alleged relationship with both girls. He's charged in Dakota County District Court with two counts of first-degree sexual assault of a child and single counts of tampering with a witness, first-degree sexual assault by a school employee, child abuse, and enticement by electronic communication device. According to court documents, Rogers had sex with the second high school student numerous times when she was 15 and after she turned 16. Rogers also is charged with first-degree sexual assault and child abuse in connection with the alleged assault of another 15-year-old girl at his home in December 2020. Rogers told investigators the sex was consensual. He had pleaded not guilty to all charges. Neither case is currently set for trial, and pretrial conferences are scheduled for August 16th. Rogers was fired from his job as an assistant football coach at South Sioux City on March 3, 2021, after the first girl reported the alleged assault to a school employee. Rogers was arrested later that month and remains in custody in the Dakota County Jail. And now these local news briefs. Rap artist Tech N9ne to perform at Anthem. From Sioux City. The nationally known rap artist Tech N9ne is coming to Hard Rock Hotel and Casino's Anthem at 111 3rd Street on September 18th. Since dropping his first album in 1999, Tech N9ne has earned 3 gold records, sold more than 2 million albums, founded his own record label, Strange Music, worked with rappers such as Lil Wayne and Kendrick Lamar, and made multiple appearances on Forbes' Hip Hop Cash Kings list. In 2005, the Kansas City rapper's song, The Beast, was featured on that year's installment of the popular Madden video game franchise. Tickets will go on sale Friday at HardRockCasinoSiouxCity.com or in person at the hotel's Rock Shop. All Anthem events are for guests 21 and older. Police offer guidance for ATV-UTV operation from Sioux City. The Sioux City Police Department is offering guidance to all-terrain vehicle and utility terrain vehicle operators in advance of a new state law that goes into effect Friday. Iowa House File 2130 legalizes the use of ATVs and UTVs on a limited number of roadways. Cities are allowed to regulate operation of such vehicles on two-lane primary and secondary road extensions. ATVs and UTVs cannot be used on highways greater than two lanes, regardless of location in the city or county. The city currently has no ordinances that either restrict or allow ATV-UTV usage on city streets beyond what is indicated in the new state law. The following roads are the only roads in Sioux City where ATV and UTV usage is legal, based on the amended laws. K-29, Old Lakeport Road south of DeRocher Path. D-18, Correctionville Road east of Camp High Hopes. D-25, Old Highway 141, southeast of the entrance to the cemetery. ATV and UTV operation on other streets is not permitted. A violation carries a fine of $70. Individuals who choose to operate ATVs or UTVs on approved roadways must also comply with the following restrictions. The driver of the ATV or UTV must be at least 18 and have financial liability coverage in effect for the vehicle and carry proof of such insurance. The ATV-UTV must display lighted headlamps at all times while the vehicle is operated on the highway. Sioux City's Fall Game Con is August 19th through 21st, from Sioux City. Fall Game Con, Sioux City's game convention for video and tabletop games of all types, is returning to the Abu Bakr Shrine Temple, August 19th through 21st. Game Con Fall will fill two floors of the Shrine Temple with video game tournaments, card games, board games, Dungeons & Dragons Adventurers League regular and epic adventures, medieval combat demonstrations, and more. Game Con also features a large vendor hall, charity auction, and local artists vending and creating game and geek culture art on site. We are very excited to return to the wonderful Abu Bakr Shrine Temple for our Fall Game Con event. This is a family-friendly event with tabletop and video games of all kinds run by local volunteers, said Bart Miller, founder and event manager. For more information, visit tabletop.events/conventions/sioux-city-games-con-fall-2022. And finally, Terrence Simeon and the Zydeco Experience added to SITP's main stage lineup from Sioux City. Grammy Award-winning Terrence Simeon and the Zydeco Experience have been added to Saturday at the park's main stage lineup. Known for hypnotic New Orleans funk reggae blended with blues world music, Terrence Simeon and the Zydeco Experience was a last-minute SITP replacement for the indie rock group Daisy the Great, headed by musicians Mina Walker and Kelly Nicole Dugan. The group announced they had to cancel due to Dugan's positive COVID-19 test. New York-based Daisy the Great was slated to appear at Grandview Park's main stage at 3 p.m. Saturday. "We aren't able to travel to Iowa to play this weekend," Daisy the Great said in a post added to Saturday in the park's website Wednesday night. Terrence Simeon and the Zydeco Experience will take Daisy the Great's time slot at 3 p.m. Saturday. The rest of the main stage shows will remain unchanged, SITP organizer Dave Bernstein said. And now these stories in national news. Court limits EPA in curbing emissions. Mark Sherman reports from Washington. In a blow to the fight against climate change, the Supreme Court on Thursday limited how the nation's main anti-air pollution law can be used to reduce carbon dioxide emissions from power plants. By a 6-3 vote, with conservatives in the majority, the court said that the Clean Air Act does not give the Environmental Protection Agency broad authority to regulate greenhouse gas emissions from power plants that contribute to global warming. The decision, said environmental advocates and dissenting liberal justices, was a major step in the wrong direction, a gut punch, one prominent meteorologist said, at a time of increasing environmental damage attributable to climate change amid dire warnings about the future. The court's ruling could complicate the administration's plans to combat climate change. Its detailed proposal to regulate power plant emissions is expected by the end of the year. Though the decision was specific to the EPA, it was in line with the conservative majority's skepticism of the power of regulatory agencies, and it sent a message on a possible future effects beyond climate change and air pollution. President Joe Biden aims to cut the nation's greenhouse gas emissions in half by the end of the decade, and to have an emissions-free power sector by 2035. Power plants account for roughly 30% of carbon dioxide output. Capping carbon dioxide emissions at a level that will force a nationwide transition away from the use of coal to generate electricity may be a sensible solution to the crisis of the day, Chief Justice John Roberts wrote in his opinion for the court. But Roberts wrote that the Clean Air Act doesn't give EPA the authority to do so, and that Congress must speak clearly on the subject. "A decision of such magnitude and consequence rests with Congress itself, or an agency acting pursuant to a clear delegation from that representative body," he wrote. In a dissent, Justice Elena Kagan wrote that the decision strips the EPA of the power Congress gave it to respond to the most pressing environmental challenge of our time. Kagan said that the stakes in the case are high. She said the court appoints itself, instead of Congress or the expert agency, the decision-maker on climate policy. "I cannot think of many things more frightening." Biden, in a statement, called the ruling another devastating decision that aims to take our country backwards. He said he would not relent in using my lawful authority to protect public health and tackle the climate crisis. And EPA head Michael Regan said his agency will move forward with a rule to impose environmental standards on the energy sector. United Nations spokesman Stephanie Dujarric also weighed in to call the decision a setback in our fight against climate change, when we are already far off track in meeting the goals of the Paris Agreement, the International Climate Accord that U.S. left during the Trump administration and re-entered once Biden took office. Jackson sworn in, becomes first black woman on Supreme Court. Mark Sherman reports from Washington. Ketanji Brown Jackson was sworn in to the Supreme Court on Thursday, shattering a glass ceiling as the first black woman on the nation's highest court. The 51-year-old Jackson is the court's 116th justice, and she took the place of the justice she once worked for. Justice Stephen Breyer's retirement was effective at noon. Moments later, joined by her family, Jackson recited the two oaths required of Supreme Court justices, one administered by Breyer and the other by Chief Justice John Roberts. With a full heart, I accept the solemn responsibility of supporting and defending the Constitution of the United States and administering justice without fear or favor, so help me God, Jackson said in a statement issued by the court. I am truly grateful to be part of the promise of our great nation. I extend my sincerest thanks to all of my new colleagues for their warm and gracious welcome. Roberts welcomed Jackson to the court and our common calling. The ceremony was streamlined live on the court's website. Jackson, a federal judge since 2013, is joining three other women, Justices Sonia Sotomayor, Elena Kagan, and Amy Coney Barrett. It's the first time four women will serve together on the nine-member court. Biden nominated Jackson in February, a month after Breyer, 83, announced he would retire at the end of the court's term, assuming his successor had been confirmed. Breyer's earlier-than-usual announcement and the condition he attached was a recognition of the Democrats' tenuous hold on the Senate in an era of hyper-partisanship, especially surrounding federal judgeships. The Senate confirmed Jackson's nomination in early April by a 53-47 mostly party-line vote that included support from three Republicans. Jackson had been in a sort of judicial limbo since, remaining a judge on the Federal Appeals Court in Washington, D.C., but not hearing any cases. Biden elevated her to that court from the district judgeship to which she was appointed by President Barack Obama. Glenda Carr, president of Higher Heights for America, an organization that advocates for the growth of black women's political power, said the timing of Jackson's swearing-in was bittersweet. Although we celebrate her today, one black woman or a cohort of black women can't save this democracy alone. We are a piece of it, and we are doing our work, our part. She's going to forever reshape and shape that court, but she's just a piece of the work that needs to happen moving forward, Carr said. Because of Jackson's appointment, Judith Brown Deanis, a black lawyer in Washington, said she intends to end her protest against joining the Supreme Court bar. She started it when Justice Clarence Thomas was confirmed in 1991. She said that even the series of conservative rulings from the court over the past week cannot take away from the significance of Thursday's ceremony. This is a momentous occasion, and it's still a beautiful moment, said Deanis, executive director of the civil rights group Advancement Project. But, Deanis added, she's joining the court at a time when conservatives are holding the line and trying to actually take us back, because they see the progress that's being made in our country. It's like the Civil War that never ended. That's the court that she's joining. Once again, you're listening to this reading of the Sioux City Journal for today, Friday, July 1st, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. And now we turn to today's obituaries. Sonia R. Grimsley, 53, of Bronson, Iowa, passed away Tuesday, June 28th, surrounded by her family. Services will be held at 10 a.m. on Wednesday at Meyer Brothers Morningside Chapel. Visitation will be from 5 to 7 p.m. on Tuesday at the funeral home. Burial will be at Lakeview Gardens in Okoboji, Iowa. Online memorials may be made to meyerbroschapels.com. Sonia was born on February 13, 1969, in Spencer, Iowa, to Christian and Barbara Ball Durkop. She graduated high school from Sergeant Bluff in 1987 and went on to obtain her bachelor's and master's degrees in teaching from Morningside College. Sonia began her teaching career in Red Oak, Iowa. She then spent 28 years as a special education teacher at East Middle School, where she touched a lot of lives. Sonia's legacy will live on through her passion of teaching. She loved all the kids, teachers, and administrators, and truly missed being at school during the past year. She was united in marriage to Craig Grimsley on December 1st, 2000, in Sioux City. To this union, they were blessed with two sons. Sonia enjoyed going to the pool, shopping, going to Kansas City Chiefs games, family vacations, and attending her boys' sporting events. She was a member of Grace United Methodist Church and the 100-plus women's group. Sonia was a great mother, loving friend, and strong fighter. She is survived by her husband, Craig Grimsley of Bronson, her sons, Kellen and Loudon Grimsley, both of Bronson, her mother, Barbara Dierkop of Sioux City, siblings Stephanie Chapman and her husband Randy of Sioux City, Brenda Olson and her husband Mark of Spirit Lake, and Chad Dierkop and his wife Jody of Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and several nieces and nephews. She was preceded in death by her father, Christian, and one nephew, Zachary E. Carter. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made to the American Cancer Society at cancer.org. And finally, Elizabeth Shaw, 88, of Lakewood, Colorado, formerly of Lamar's, died Thursday, June 23rd. Services will be July 8th at 1 p.m. at Maurer Johnson Funeral Home in Lamar's. Burial will follow the services at Hillside Cemetery in Merrill, Iowa. Visitation will be July 8th from 12 p.m. until service time at the funeral home. And now these other stories in national news. President backs change. Biden puts support behind an exception to protect abortion rights. Chris Magarian reports from Washington. President Joe Biden said Thursday that he would support an exception to the Senate filibuster to protect abortion access, a shift that comes as Democrats coalesce around an election year message intended to rally voters who are outraged or deflated by the Supreme Court decision overturning Roe v. Wade. Although Democrats already control the Senate by the narrowest of margins, there isn't enough support within their caucus to change the filibuster rule, which allows any member to block legislation unless it receives 60 votes. But Biden's statement was the latest indication that, if the party picks up a few more seats in the midterm elections in November, Democrats could seize the opportunity to pass legislation creating a nationwide right to abortion. If the filibuster gets in the way, it's like voting rights, Biden said, referencing the rare other issue where he supports sidestepping the rule. Speaking during a news conference in Madrid, where he was attending a NATO summit, the Democratic president said there should be an exception to the filibuster for this action to deal with the Supreme Court decision. Democrats hold 50 seats in the 100-person Senate, with Vice President Kamala Harris able to break ties when she presides over the Senate. It would take 51 votes to change the filibuster rule. But at least two Democratic senators, Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona, don't support changing the filibuster rule. Harris said earlier this week that the votes don't exist for changing the filibuster now. "Why are we talking about hypotheticals?" she told NPR. The president has been under pressure to take as much executive action as possible to protect abortion rights, although his options are limited. Biden said he's meeting Friday with governors to talk about abortion, and "I'll have announcements to make then." As Biden gave remarks in Madrid, judges in two U.S. states took steps to block enforcement of abortion bans. A Florida judge said Thursday he will temporarily block a 15-week ban on abortions in his state, but his bench ruling won't take effect before the ban becomes law Friday, an issue that could cause confusion for patients as well as abortion providers. And in Kentucky, a judge temporarily blocked that state's near-total ban on abortions, allowing the procedures to resume after they were abruptly stopped when the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. The state quickly appealed the judge's order. Abortion ruling cited in Alabama case. State law imposes ban on medical treatments for transgender youth. Kim Chandler reports from Montgomery, Alabama. Days after the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that states can prohibit abortion, Alabama has seized on the decision to argue that the state should also be able to ban gender-affirming medical treatments for transgender youths. The case marks one of the first known instances in which a conservative state has tried to apply the abortion ruling to other realms, just as LGBTQ advocates and others were afraid would happen. Critics have expressed fear that the legal reasoning behind the High Court ruling could lead to a rollback of decisions involving such matters as gay marriage, birth control, and parental rights. The state is asking a federal appeals court to lift an injunction and let it enforce an Alabama law that would make it a felony to give puberty blockers or hormones to transgender minors to help affirm their gender identity. In its ruling last Friday, the U.S. Supreme Court said terminating a pregnancy is not a constitutional right because abortion is not mentioned in the Constitution and is not deeply rooted in this nation's history and tradition. In a brief filed Monday, the Alabama Attorney General's office argued similarly that gender transition treatments are not deeply rooted in our history or traditions, and thus the state has the authority to ban them. Alabama contends such treatments are dangerous. Shannon Minter, legal director of the National Center for Lesbian Rights, said this is the first case he is aware of in which a state cited the abortion ruling on another issue, but added it won't be the last. Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito said in the majority opinion that the abortion ruling should not cast doubt on precedents that do not concern abortion. But Justice Clarence Thomas wrote that the same legal reasoning should be used to reconsider high court rulings protecting same-sex marriage, gay sex, and contraceptives. In the aftermath of the Supreme Court's so-called Dobbs decision, Republican Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton, in an interview with News Nation, did not rule out defending a state law against gay sex if the legislature were to approve a new one. The previous one was struck down by the high court in 2003. The Alabama case could become an early test of where judges stand on the scope of the abortion ruling. A decision in the case could come as early as this fall. U.S. COVID booster requires updating. FDA says vaccine will need to protect against new Omicron relatives. U.S. regulators told COVID-19 vaccine makers Thursday that any booster shots tweaked for the fall will have to add protection against the newest Omicron relatives. The Food and Drug Administration said the original vaccines would be used for anyone still getting their first series of shots. But with immunity waning and the super contagious Omicron family of variants getting better at dodging protection, the FDA decided boosters intended for fall needed an update. The recipe? Combination shots that add protection against the Omicron relatives named BA.4 and BA.5 to the original vaccine. Those mutants together now account for just over half of new U.S. infections. It's still a gamble, as there's no way to know if an Omicron relative still will be a threat as cold weather approaches, or if a newer mutant will take its place. But the combination approach, what scientists call bivalent shots, would allow the boosters to retain the proven benefits of the original vaccine while adding to its breadth of protection. Pfizer and Moderna already were brewing and testing boosters updated against the first Omicron mutant in anticipation of an October rollout. Pfizer had begun work on another experimental dose to target the newer strains the FDA ultimately settled on. Court rules Biden can end asylum policy. Trump-era rule forced some migrants to wait in Mexico for hearings. Jessica Greska reports from Washington. The Supreme Court said Thursday the Biden administration can scrap a Trump-era immigration policy to make asylum seekers wait in Mexico for hearings in U.S. immigration courts, a victory for a White House that still must address the number of people seeking refuge at the southern border. The ruling will have little immediate impact because the policy has been seldom applied under President Joe Biden, who reinstated it under a court order in December. It was his predecessor, Donald Trump, who launched the Remain in Mexico policy. Biden suspended the policy, formerly known as Migrant Protection Protocols, in January 2021, but lower courts ordered it reinstated in response to a lawsuit from Texas and Missouri. The case was about whether U.S. immigration authorities, with far less detention capacity than needed, had to send asylum seekers to Mexico, or if they could be released into the United States while they awaited their hearings. After Biden suspended the program, Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas ended it in June 2021. Chief Justice John Roberts, joined by Brett Kavanaugh and the court's three liberal justices, wrote that an appeals court erred in holding that the Federal Immigration and Nationality Act required the government to continue implementing MBP. Poll. Nearly half say Trump should be charged for January 6th. From Washington, about half of Americans believe former President Donald Trump should be charged with a crime for his role in the U.S. Capitol attack on January 6th, 2021, a new poll shows. The survey from the Associated Press NORC Center for Public Affairs Research finds that 48% of U.S. adults say the Republican former president should be charged with a crime for his role, while 31% say he should not be charged. An additional 20% say they don't know enough to have an opinion. 58% say Trump bears a great deal or quite a bit of responsibility for what happened that day. The poll was conducted after five public hearings by the House Committee investigating January 6th, which has sought to paint Trump's potential criminal culpability in the events that led to deadly insurrection. But it was taken before Tuesday's surprise hearing featuring former Trump White House aide Cassidy Hutchinson. Her explosive testimony provided the most compelling evidence yet that the former president could be linked to a federal crime, experts say. Views on Trump's criminal liability break down predictably along party lines, with 86% of Democrats but only 10% of Republicans saying Trump should be charged with a crime. Among Republicans, 68% say he should not be charged, and 21% say they don't know. Still, the fact that nearly half the country believes he should be prosecuted is a remarkable position for the former president, pointing to the difficulties he could face if he makes another run at the White House in 2024. For Ella Metz, a South Carolina Democrat, Trump's culpability has been clear from the beginning, when he urged his supporters to march to the Capitol on the morning of January 6th and fight like hell. It was meant to provoke violence because he kept encouraging them, the 86-year-old told the Associated Press. As it happened, I watched it all, and I just thought, why doesn't somebody stop this? Why doesn't he stop this? Chris Schlomer, a Texas independent, agreed Trump holds responsibility for egging on the crowd with his baseless claims of election fraud. But the 61-year-old doesn't lay the blame solely on Trump. Schlomer feels Republicans in Congress have a hand in what happened that day, too. I feel like people were afraid of Donald Trump, especially Republican politicians, and so they wouldn't rein him in. And I think that just emboldened him. And he's not alone. While views of Trump's role have not changed since December, Americans are somewhat more likely now than they were then to say Republicans in Congress were significantly responsible for the events of January 6th. 46% say that now, up slightly from 41% in December. An additional 21% say GOP lawmakers had some responsibility, and 30% say they were not responsible. The change in the share, saying Republicans in Congress have a large amount of responsibility, was driven mostly by Democrats and independents. Ulysses Bryant, a Democrat from Florida, said while he always believed Trump and the rioters should be charged with a crime, he hadn't known of the involvement of congressional Republicans until he began to follow the hearings. Close to 6 in 10 Americans, 56%, say they followed news about the congressional hearings. A smaller but still sizable share, 42%, say they watched or listened. The 9-member panel, comprising 7 Democrats and 2 Republicans, has worked around the clock for the past year to investigate the connection between Trump and his allies and the violence and chaos that ensued on the Capitol. The public hearing phase of their investigation is meant to put all of that investigative work on display to the American public in an effort to create a historical record of what happened. 75% of Democrats and 42% of Republicans say they followed news about the hearings. More Democrats than Republicans also say they tuned in, 58% to 27%. The first of the public hearings, which began in early June, received high ratings for TV viewership, though subsequent hearings have received more modest ratings. And now these stories in local sports. Explorers offense explodes in win. Sioux City scores season-high 12 runs against Canaries. Will Glocker reports from Sioux City. In Game 2 of the series, the Sioux City Explorers struck for 12 runs on 15 hits in a 12-4 victory over the Sioux Falls Canaries. Chase Harris, for a second consecutive night, led off the first with a double. Trey Martin followed a batter later with a double to score Harris, giving the X's a 1-0 lead. The Explorers kept the offense going in the second, adding two more runs. With two outs, Nate Sampson reached on an error and was driven in on a Tyler Rando double. After a second error of the frame, Danny Amaral singled to score Rando and added to the X's lead 3-0. Sioux Falls struck back with a run of their own in the third. After three straight singles, Gavin LaValle, with two outs, singled to score Angelo Altavilla, making it 3-1 Explorers. The Canaries cut down the X's lead to 1 in the fourth. John Nestor hit a one-out solo homer to cut the lead to 3-2. The Explorers answered that fourth-inning Canary run with a run of their own in the bottom half. Nate Sampson led off with a solo shot of his own, extending it to 4-2 Explorers. For the Canaries, Tyler Garkow, who is 0-3, went 5 innings, allowing 4 runs, 2 earned. Garkow gave up 7 hits, 1 walk, and struck out 2 while taking the loss. The X's in the 6th grabbed 3 more runs. Tony Lanier walked 3 straight to open up the inning. Tyler Rando scored on a wild pitch from 3rd. Martin singled, scoring Amaral, and Adamar Rafaela hit a sacrifice slide to score Harris to put the X's ahead 7-2. Tom Wendell, who's at 1-2, pitched 6 innings, getting the win. Wendell gave up 10 hits and 2 runs, but was also able to strike out 8 Canary batters. The X's added 5 more runs in the 7th, with another 2-out rally. After 2 quick outs, Sioux City collected 6 consecutive hits. Sampson started a 2-out rally with a double and was brought home by a Rando single. 3 more singles by Harris, Amaral, and Martin kept the 2-out rally going. Rafaela doubled, scoring the 4th and 5th run of the inning in Amaral and Martin to put the X's up 12-2. Sioux Falls gained 2 more runs in the 9th. 2 walks and a 2-out double by Trey Michalczewski scored Angelo Altavilla and Wyatt Ulrich. Sioux City took the win 12-4. The Game 3 rubber match between Sioux Falls and Sioux City will take place at 7.05 p.m. on Thursday. Starting for the Explorers will be righty Zach Hedges, who is 0-2 with a 4.98 average. The Canaries give the ball to lefty Ty Culbreth, who is 4-3 with a 4.71 average. And one game from the prep roundup. East softball splits double with Yellow Jackets. Bailey Zubke reports from Council Bluffs. Briley Hempe recorded 3 hits, including a home run, and 5 RBI to lead East to an 11-6 win over Jefferson. Kennedy Wineland and Olivia Mincer added 2 hits and 2 RBIs each for East. Hempe struck out 5 in a complete game win. Carly Steinspring tallied 3 hits for the Yellow Jackets. And in high school track and field, Latham leaps into history. Spirit Lake senior breaks 110-meter all-time record. Zach James reports. Jack Latham knew from the beginning of the season his senior campaign would be an unforgettable one. The Spirit Lake High School senior and this year's Male Track and Field Athlete of the Year ran a fast time in an indoor meet. He saw how quickly he ran the 60-meter hurdles, and later this season he made history on track's biggest stage. I knew I had to make the most of it, Latham said. I was feeling a little stressed before the state meet because I knew I was going to do good. I still needed to perform my best. I put a lot of weight on myself, but in the end it helped me. The once-in-a-lifetime moment came at the state track and field meet last month in Des Moines. Latham was getting ready to run in the Class 2A 110-meter hurdle preliminaries, and it was the only race Latham was running on May 20th. He had a busy weekend, as Latham was also running in the 100, 200, and shuttle hurdle relays. I ran those other 3 races on Thursday, and it was a pretty good day, Latham said. That Thursday was hot, and it was not enjoyable. Friday was a mild 70-degree day with no winds. I knew I had to make it a special time. On that Friday, though, Latham's attention fully turned to the 110s. He knew he could go all out, and that was his strategy. He figured he could get re-energized after that afternoon race for the Saturday finals. Latham had a strong start out of the blocks. He used that power to glide through the hurdles on the Drake Stadium front stretch and cross the finish line with a time of 13.74 seconds. After, public address announcer Mike Jay let the crowd know that it was an all-time best, the emotions hit Latham like a brick wall. He knew it was a moment he'd never forget. "I knew if there was a time to get that record, it'd have to be that day," Latham said. "I knew I had a good race coming through the finish line. I thought I had the record, but I didn't know I beat it by over a tenth of a second. Looking up, I'm sure people have seen the video, but it was a pretty fun moment for me." Latham started the season with a strong performance at the Dickinson Relays on March 8th at the UNI Dome in Cedar Falls. Latham started off the premier indoor meet of the season by running a 7.98 in the preliminaries. Then, in the finals, Latham then ran a 7.89 in the 60-meter hurdle finals, which gave him the win among runners statewide. That time also put the future Iowa State hurdler 11th in the nation in that race at that time. "I knew I was going to have a really good season if I was going to keep on working," Latham said. "We just had the same workout regimens in indoor or outdoor. The endurance part in indoor is right in the beginning of the season if you just keep working out in practices." Latham then had a hot start to his season, including wins at the Sioux City Relays. A couple weeks later, Latham had a busy Drake Relays. His day started off by having the fastest time in the 110-meter hurdles as he won the prelims in 14.24 seconds. Latham defended that number one seed in the finals as he won the white flag in the 110s with a time of 13.99 seconds. He won the race by 0.61 seconds. Latham also placed third in the Drake 100-meter finals with a time of 10.99 seconds. He was one of three non-Class 4A runners in the race, with the other two being Harlan's Aiden Hall and Indians mentor Kai Hussey. Latham was also among the Indians squad of the shuttle hurdle relay. He was the anchor runner behind Ethan Stecker, Jake Cornwall, and Drew Alger. And finally, in Cornhuskers basketball, way ahead of schedule. Griesel using hip rehab as leadership opportunity. Jimmy Watkins reports from Lincoln, Nebraska. Nebraska guard Sam Griesel feels no pain in his surgically repaired hip. Griesel, who had surgery on March 31st, is progressing through rehab faster than expected, way ahead of schedule, according to NU coach Fred Hoiberg. But Griesel can't play yet. Instead, Griesel wakes up each morning and performs a repetitive 3-hour workout. Weights, form shooting, stationary ball handling drills, pool workouts some days, bike workouts others. Griesel calls these the dog days of his recovery, and they are dragging by. "I'm not a patient person at all," Griesel said, "so I'm just growing in that aspect and not trying to do too much. At this point, if I do too much, it's going to set me back." Griesel's hip has been bothering him for years, dating back to his junior season at South Dakota State. During games, he didn't feel it, too much adrenaline, but afterward, he suffered. Griesel remembers moments when he couldn't stand up after sitting through a post-game speech. He couldn't even move his leg. "It was mentally draining, too," he said. "I remember feeling like, oh my gosh, this hurts so bad, I can't even move." Griesel chose surgery this spring with the future in mind. He powered through the pain last season, but he worried about his longevity if he left the hip untreated. He plans to play pro ball, and it was better to have surgery now than to play on it for 5 more years, and then I can't play again, Griesel said. That logic put Griesel in new territory, though. Before surgery, the Lincoln native said he'd never been sidelined longer than 6 or 7 weeks due to injury. He's already missed 12 and counting this summer. He's using that downtime to help tutor Nebraska's up-and-coming ball handlers. Griesel said Karan McPherson, Ramel Lloyd, and Cale Jacobson are handling most point guard duties during his absence. And Hoiberg said Griesel stops each player between reps to offer pointers. Griesel's had plenty of time to watch film. Griesel's advice is twofold. First, don't make it complicated, he said. Second, talk during practice, about anything, really. During Griesel's freshman season at NDSU, he had an older teammate that would yell, "Pizza!" during practices. "Sometimes I'll just say random words so it gets energy going," Griesel said. "I tell them, say anything. Anything helps. Even if you're saying pizza, I know where you are. Talk always helps." Hoiberg sees Griesel's advice taking hold. Lloyd and fellow true freshman Jamarcus Lawrence are getting louder every day. And generally, Hoiberg has seen fewer reasons to interrupt practice. Players are correcting issues he normally would. Nebraska doesn't run a play until every offensive player echoes the call. The Huskers bemoaned their play call communication after multiple losses last season. "Those little things, I think, make a big difference," Hoiberg said. "The little things are going to get us over the hump." And that does it for today's reading of the Sioux City Journal for today, Friday, July 1st. I'm your reader, Mark Bedford. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And thanks for listening.